Quasar Rowlands asks us whether organizational structures actually embody stated commitments. Catherine Bradshaw, whom we interviewed before along with John Lockman, now brings the same scrutiny to how schools organize prevention, intervention, and support. Schools often accumulate worthwhile programs without building the teams, data routines, coaching, and leadership needed to connect them, and the result can be overload rather than coherence. Catherine uses the example of how positive behavioral interventions and supports, PBIS, can serve as an operating system, not one more program competing for space, but organizing the teams, data, and tiered structure within which social and emotional learning and other evidence-based practices and programs can actually run well. Catherine is candid about the risk. More is not automatically better. Too many components at once can overwhelm educators, blur what is actually driving results, and weaken implementation. The practical questions are, what problems are we solving? Which approach belongs at which tier and for which students? And what can staff realistically implement well and with what types of coaching? And finally, what evidence will tell us whether the combination is helping both individual students and students as a whole? Rather than a catalog of programs, this conversation is an on-ramp for examining coherence in your own school, looking at the interventions already in place, identifying what infrastructure they share, and asking honestly whether the school is building collective capacity or just adding demands and contributing to what staff often talk about as innovation fatigue. That question leads naturally into our final conversation with Jane Quinn, who asks how a school and its community partners can organize the whole institution, not just its programs, around student success. As you listen, think about your own setting. Are you adding programs or building an operating system to enable those programs to work? And where might greater alignment reduce the burden while actually improving the experience of staff and students? Thank you, Catherine, for joining this conversation. Both of our research examines how conditions surrounding young people shape their learning, their development, their well-being, and their thriving. Your work is focused particularly on school-wide prevention, tiered systems of support, school climate, and targeted interventions, while much of mine has focused on the conditions for learning and the alignment of services and supports. When these elements are genuinely aligned rather than simply placed alongside one another, what should students, families, and educators experience differently? What distinguishes a coherent system of support from a school that has accumulated several tens and twenties of individual programs that are providing support?
David, I'm really excited to be here today and to talk with you. I really got interested in this topic because I started off my career working in juvenile justice, and I started off as a perhaps a little naive person working, thinking if I could just go in and help out this kid and help out that kid, I could super fix this system. And the more I interacted with youth, the more they would tell me, "Hear about the 15th lady that tried to help me." And going into juvenile justice settings and thinking, "Well, if I could just turn the light on and if I could just help this one kid and help that kid and provide this kind of service and do that." And it really helped me understand that we needed a systems change and we needed to think differently about how we were doing prevention. And in fact, I was a trainee at the University of Georgia and the Juvenile Counseling and Assessment System. Wonderful program, but it really made me think I needed to just reboot the way that I was going about my systems alignment and my kind of systems training. And while the University of Georgia was a wonderful place to do my training, and I have recently revisited that group, was welcomed back to receive an alumni award and revisited with some of the students there, it made me think we needed a systems approach to the way that we do prevention. And that's why I shifted gears from doing counseling-based work to do more prevention science-based work and more systems alignment. And so, to your point, I think we need much more systems integration and we need to be thinking about tiered systems. And that's when I shifted over to doing more of a prevention science type of approach and how we do prevention through schools. And I went from Athens, Georgia to Ithaca, New York, a little bit of a Greek theme there, and really started working with the BOCES system in upstate New York and doing work. And it was really a very interesting and innovative approach. They had alternative school placements working in retirement communities and community-based supports for kids, getting them out of traditional school-based systems and thinking about how can we help kids in authentic learning environments, in non-traditional learning environments, helping them get job placements and skill development outside of the school. And this is the early stage of positive behavior support without that kind of labeling. And having special education and counseling and other teachers providing support for kids with guidance counselors and special educators and parents and community providers and some job placements for youth. And it was really very eye-opening for me. And I did some of my additional training in that setting and learned about tiered supports within that kind of setting. And that really was very eye-opening for me. It was also the time that a lot of the work around fast track was coming out. And I really learned a lot about tiered supports as an application. And that was very influential in my own career. I also had an opportunity as I transferred into my first faculty appointment working on some of the early studies of positive behavior support, now referred to as multi-tiered systems of support, and the systems approach, including a public health approach. And it's really hard for me to go back now after I've had that eye-opening experience and had that. And I think this is really where the field must go. And as I look to so many of my colleagues that have done critical work in this space, like Sharon Stephen Hoover and others who are doing just critical work in this, and Mark Wiest and other colleagues of mine and centers of school mental health all around the country who have been very critical leaders and yourself included in this space. And I think we do need to have families at the table. You know, many of us have been calling for more family engagement, and that is an area that I've been leaning into more recently through some of the work that we've been doing in Coping Power of historically, how do we bring families to schools? And now it's more about how do we bring programming to families through nudges and through other alternative programming that we're going to families more rather than expecting families to come into schools. Andy Garbetz, for example, at Wisconsin, is doing excellent work around family engagement through multi-tiered systems of support. So this has been a lifelong passion of mine to think about starting in juvenile justice and now thinking about alternative programming that involves families across multiple tiers and many different ways of integrating evidence-based practices across the tiers. I, like you, have been in a lifelong journey in this area. And always constantly learning and innovating and bringing technology and partnering with different people in this space.
In a subsequent conversation, we'll be talking much more about family engagement, but you also raised fast track. And what are some of the lessons that we can derive from an incredibly well-funded, very well-enriched, and also expensive program, but that suggests things about what are possible for young people?
I have never directly been involved in Fast Track, but I've been a fan club member and an admirer and a learner of this. Fast Track was a very important and influential study that began in the 90s and included some of the leaders in the field of prevention science, including John Lockman and Mark Greenberg and Ken Dodge and Bob McMahon, among others, Karen Bierman, and included a number of evidence-based practices that were developmentally sequenced and combined that started in elementary school and followed youth through middle school and ultimately through high school. And so they were paired, including some universal programming, including the PATHS program and a program called Coping Power. And then there were some mentoring programs. There were also a number of innovative methodological advances that created that included Linda Collins and others with some adaptive programming that were created through the adolescent phase. And this has had a tremendous impact on not only the youth that participated in the program, but also our understanding of what works for whom, under what conditions. And a lot of longitudinal studies that have followed the youth that participate in those programs, even some more recent genetic and economic analysis, including folks like Max Crowley and more recent colleagues. Bob McMahon has been very involved in some of the more recent iterations in the genetic studies as well. I won't go into that, but there are literally books that have been written, and John Cooey has also been very involved in that work. So I'd refer you on to the hundreds, literally, of articles that have been written in that area. Many studies have been coming out of that, but I was particularly interested in how one could adapt programs and try to understand what works for whom and how we create different interventions in the tiered structure. I have also been working with some of the individual interventions, including the PAS curriculum, and blending that with other interventions at times, including the Good Behavior Game, as well as the Coping Power program. That's a more of a pullout program for kids that were screened at risk for aggressive behavior problems.
Let me move into integration, and I'm going to ask you two questions. One about aligning PBIS and social emotional learning. You have both done work in both areas, and you led a very important book chapter trying to show how the two could be aligned. And then, given what you just said, and I knew about this part of your work, I want you to talk about the alignment with paths and a few other things. And the reason I'm going to ask you that is in the next episode, we're going to start hearing about Cleveland. And when I first was doing my consulting with Cleveland, I actually suggested to them that they combine paths which they had chosen with the Good Behavior Game. They chose not to. They felt it would have been too demanding for them, and they may have been right. But I'd be interested in sharing with the audience how one can work to try to align different powerful interventions in ways that work for young people and are implementable by people on the ground. So SEL and PBIS first.
Sure. Since I had been doing quite a bit of work in the framework, which is positive behavior support. In fact, some of my early work in that was with a series of colleagues in Maryland. When I first joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins, there was an ongoing trial, which I joined early in my faculty career, led by Phil Leaf and at the time Susan Keyes, who early after I joined the faculty there, she left Hopkins to become the prevention lead at SAMHSA. So I took over her role as one of the PIs on that project. And as a early learner in that space, I was very quickly convinced of the power of that as a framework for implementing other evidence-based practices, not necessarily as a program in and of itself, but as a conduit or an implementation framework for doing other things better, because it really has a focus on data, systems, and practices. And so, while some may think of it as a program, it's really an implementation framework for doing other practices better. And so, while you do have to focus on building the infrastructure for that framework, it can quickly be used to implement other practices once you get that installation in place. And so, we have since gone on to do several trials for now of Tier 1, Tier 2, and two other trials combining it with other programs, including social emotional learning frameworks and across elementary, middle, and high school. And so I'm happy to provide some suggested references that could accompany the podcast here. And we've also done studies combining social emotional learning, including the PAS curriculum, in combination with the classroom management program, Good Behavior Game. And so I tend to think of these as frameworks or like an operating system for your computer. And so how you can get an implementation framework in place to do other things better. And so while initially some people found resistance to that, thinking, oh, is that going to flood the system? Are you trying to do too much? But if you think about it from an implementation science framework, you want to pull up like a software program, but if you have a general logic about how you want to do that, like opening up Windows, and if I want to write a paper or if I want to crunch some numbers, if I have a general heuristic about how I'm going to do that, it makes doing other things simpler. So if I have a team to run another program, or if I have a data system, I can do other things better. And so that's really how I view and how I think schools that are doing positive behavior support approach that. And so we can optimize the way that we want to do other kinds of programs and practices better. And so it took a while for people to understand that kind of framework rather than thinking of PBIS as a program in competition with other things. And sometimes people get stuck on, oh, is it too behaviorist? Are we training people to be drones? Are we over reinforcing things and tricking people into doing things? But that's really not what PBIS is about. It's not about tricking and over reinforcing. It's really about the behaviors practices when done correctly. And in fact, a lot of social emotional learning practices also use a reinforcement system. And when done correctly, it also can be very powerful. So we've done a number of studies. And in many ways, if you think about you're driving a car, you need a brake system as well as a gas system. You need a brake pedal and a go pedal. And so when you think about something like social emotional learning, you have a reinforcement system as well as helping kids inhibit kind of problem behaviors. And so quite often it's helpful to have both of those to operate your car or operate your classroom. And so you want to have an inhibition system as well as a reinforcement system. And so it's complementary to train people to do multiple things. And we're also finding a lot of crossover effects on some of our programs too, about helping kids inhibit certain things and to reinforce certain things. Having complementary and integrated programs can help cover a range of things. And so it's very helpful to be thinking about how we can integrate programs. And sometimes one program or one strategy might be enough, but sometimes combining them together can have a synergistic effect.
I think that's very right, Catherine. I think that ultimately the effectiveness of any program for any child or any teacher or practitioner is a product and part of the entire ecosystem of services and interventions that are going on in a place, and it's never one. And if they can be aligned in a way that is synergistic, as you're describing, that can happen. So how does one Let's take SEL and PBIS. I'm thinking about the book chapter into
Yeah,
that.
we've actually written a couple of them now.
Yeah. So even go update it, okay? That how does
Yeah,
one
we just more recently did one for the SEL handbook where
That's right. Yeah.
we did an updated version. In fact, when we wrote the first one, it was a little more starting from the PBIS framework, and then the more recent SEL handbook, we did one that was a little more evenly focused on SEL and in PBIS. And then we also did another one that was about indicators of PBIS and brought in SEL. So we've had quite a few of these trying to knit them together. I think they've become less controversial over time because the field has moved in that direction.
That's right. Yeah. I also think that your active role within CASEL and at the same time your continuation of your work in this other space represents the fact that the fields have evolved where that becomes much more possible.
And I also think framing the PBIS work as an implementation framework, and that's one way I've always thought about it, is it's a scale-up opportunity. Because I think one thing that PBIS always brought to the table was the scale-up potential and was the implementation arm, and sometimes was a little light on the practices. And so it was like, okay, we have this implementation framework. What are we going to do in the classroom? What is this really going to look like? How are we going to meet those goals? And SEL brought that content. And I think SEL was like, all right, we got the content, but how are we going to get this done? How are we really going to move this forward? And with the National Technical Assistance Center on Positive Behavior Support, they had the scale-up potential, and it was a perfect marriage in my mind. But I remember Roger Weisberg used to always say they're the lumpers and the splitters. I was always a lumper. I was always a
I
connector.
love that.
I had a really hard time seeing the differences. And
Yeah.
I always saw the connections almost to a fault. I was like, why can't
No.
we all be together? And he's like, there are some differences. You have a hard time seeing the fine lines, my friend. I was like, come on, let's gloss over that. And he's like, some of these things aren't gloss worthy.
But even though he was not able to sign off on it, Roger very much liked the 2014 chapter that you did. Really,
Well, it was a growth
Oh, I
opportunity
know,
for
but you're
me.
very right. That's it. And I think that everyone, and in my language, you have hedgehogs and foxes or lumpers. And the main thing is, while I'm also a lumper hedgehog, either way, you can do it well, but we need to be able not to be operating alone. Because to
Yeah.
go back to the young people that you mentioned, they weren't operating alone. They wanted people connected. And I'm thinking back to those first group of young people. So let us move
Well, my
on.
other metaphor that I use is I like to listen to a little bit of bluegrass and jam bands, and I'm, oh, we need another fiddle player. We need another bassist. Let's borrow somebody and bring somebody together. And I think it's fun to play with people, especially people that think a little differently or play a little out of tune or do this and that. And I like bringing people together, especially I learn more from people that think differently than I do. If I have all these mini-me's around, then that doesn't make life very fun. Because I've already got me, and I already think the way that I do, and I don't stretch very much if I just hang out with me and people that think like me, because I need to bring people together that think differently. And you and I were chatting a little bit before the call here today about AI, and I've been hanging out with some folks that do AI lately, and that's a whole different way of thinking. And I've been stretching in that space, and sometimes it feels awkward, and it feels different, and it's uncomfortable, but it's wow, that's a new stretch for me. And I was stretching with geneticists a few years ago, and I was stretching with economists a few years ago, and now I'm stretching with machine learning and natural language processing and AI. And it's good to stretch. And even if you go back to where you were before, it's good to stretch and then go back. And we talk about zone of proximal development, a very old concept, but we need to stretch up a little bit to figure out how we can grow. And these are good things for us to do. And if you hang out in your same box, you never grow. And we got to do that.
An interview that will be posted with this as well, and this session that we did with Kwesi Rowlands yesterday, where in the end, Kwesi was saying the same thing. What is needed is, if you want to move, is to think about who else should be at the table. Who else
Yeah.
should I be talking to? And I can tell you that I'm reading right now a book by Stanley Cuff on Charlie Parker. And one of the points he's making is the evolution of jazz was always about bringing new people and new riffs to the table. And it just becomes much more interesting. And I very much
Like
agree.
bluegrass. Now,
Yeah,
jazz and bluegrass have
exactly.
similar kind of roots.
Exactly. Exactly. All righty. So let us move from that wonderful area to an area that's painful for a lot of people, and you and I both have been concerned, which is discipline disparities. And there are a lot of things going on there, but I want to just look at it from the perspective of system alignment. And actually, from how do we realign systems so that they're not aligned pretty well to create disparities instead to that they work to undo them. Your research on discipline disparities shows that unequal outcomes cannot be explained simply by differences in student behavior. How should we understand racial disparities in referrals and suspensions as evidence of misalignment among adult perceptions, classroom practices, disciplinary policies, school climate, and student support?
Yes, we've had the opportunity to examine this intractable issue from several different perspectives. I think one of the studies you were alluding to is we had teacher ratings of student behavior on a measure we call the TOCA, Teacher Observation of Classroom Adaptation. And then we had office discipline referrals. Some were reported by the teacher and then other administrative data. And we found that even when we controlled for the teacher's own ratings of the kids' aggressive behavior, we still found that the kids were being referred to the office. So it's when teachers control for their own behavior ratings, we still found higher rates of office discipline referrals. And we even weren't able to wipe it out when we controlled for teachers' race. Black teachers were still referring Black students at a higher rate. So when we control away a lot of things statistically, we still find overrepresentation of minority students. So this has been a very challenging issue, and we bring in a variety of other controls at the school level. And we have been, as Russ Giba and others say, admiring the problem for many years, and we have been nudging the gap and not really closing it. So I've been working on this issue with many colleagues from several different fields, including clinical psychology and health disparities. And I trained as a developmental psychologist, as I mentioned, in counseling. And we have a variety of different team members that we work with in this area. We've developed a model that we refer to as double check, and we have five different elements that we focus in on. And we provide professional development at a school level as well as at a teacher level and coaching. And we really find that you have to get into the classroom to address this, because if we just hang out at the school level and address these issues, you're too late to the game. You've really got to get to the classroom and help support teachers, because office referrals really start at the classroom level. And from a systems level, what's happening at the team, because the referral happens at the classroom, the team is late to the game. We've got to address the classroom. You do have to address what's happening at the team, but through a variety of vulnerable decision points, as other colleagues refer to them as well, we got to think systems level. But we've spent a lot of time thinking about this issue from a coaching and professional development at the classroom level. And we've done a series of studies, rigorous studies funded by IES and Spencer, and have some promising data, including reducing referrals of Black students, as well as improving teacher efficacy and reducing overall rates of problems in the classroom through effective coaching of teachers and professional development using our double check model, which is effective classroom management. Because if you don't have effective classroom management, you don't have that base, but also helping teachers reflect on their own values and their own why they got into teaching. And we find that when teachers get stressed out, it activates that bias. And teachers don't go into the classroom thinking, oh, who am I going to get today? They just become stressed. And when issues of culture and race come up, that stresses teachers out. And we know that from simulation studies as well as from observational studies. And so we have a series of studies. And right now we're in our fourth of these rigorous studies that we've been launching. And we're doing it online because we are always at the end of the day trying to scale things up. How could we do things with a lighter touch? How could we do things cheaper? And how can we reach a broader audience? These are kind of value statements that we have. That how can we build a better machine that's more disseminatable and easier for people to use? One of the challenges we're having is the current climate is making it a little bit harder for us to talk about these issues. There's a lot of confusion about what can be done. There are a lot of policies in different areas that's making it harder for folks to access the free resources that we have. And there are some challenges for us to make our resources available to schools. So we're having to, in some cases, repackage and rebrand the resources that we are offering. We're also finalizing a book that will be soon available through Guilford that we've also been working on for over 10 years. And the number of times I've had to go back through this book and change a little bit of the frame and things like that because of the moving conversation in this area has also been a little bit challenging and personally a little sad for me, just about how what hasn't changed and how we're having to reframe some of the conversation in this space. Over 10 years, we really have moved the needle on some things, but haven't moved the needle in other areas.
No, I think for those of us who have been in this space, even though we have not wanted to just contemplate what is happening, it is we have watched the same issues occur again and again. Let us end with a practical question. Both of our work suggests that schools often have many necessary parts, an MTSS framework, evidence-based programs, community partnerships, climate data, and student support staff. But those pieces do not always operate as a coherent whole. Imagine a school leader today facing that situation. What is the first question that leader and leadership team should ask? And what is one concrete step that they can take next Monday to begin building a more integrated, equitable, and family and youth-driven system of support, one that engages the voices and knowledge of young people and families without placing the burden on them to navigate or repair the system?
I think starting with data is always very helpful. At times, we have advocated for school climate data to help inform decisions. We have been in a position of being able to make publicly available surveys, many of which have been available through centers that you have run through AIR, through the Safe and Supportive Learning Environments group. More recently, I've been collaborating through our Center for Rural Schools at the University of Missouri. Wendy Rinke and Keith Herman have developed a our early identification system, and it's a screener that helps us identify youth in need of supports. So those are just some examples of data systems. Office of Similar Referral data are another source, but having data as a starting point for conversation can be very helpful in bringing the team together and helping to identify areas of need. Sometimes those are negative data points, but having positive data about where your strengths are also very important for bringing the groups together. And I think can help rally everybody to say these are areas of strength as well as our areas of need. I think having a framework, I tend to like the multi-tiered systems to support. Social emotional learning is another framework. And I think those are guideposts for helping to use that data to make decisions about what evidence-based practices can be informative. Having a team to make decisions are very important. And having an implementation support plan and system to put in place, and having a coaching support, working with the outside group, whether it's a coach or somebody at the school division or state, can help advise you around that. So I think these are some things, if I were in a school leadership position, I'd be really would be on my 90-day plan. There are a variety of different models that can help you put in place. Some are branded, some are state supported in that area, but those would be some of the evidence-based approaches for school change that are effective and have been rigorously tested. And that would be my go-to model for school leadership and school change.
Catherine, thank you for playing some bluegrass with us. Thank you for
Anytime,
ripping
my
the
jam band friend. There's a